Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Joining me is tonight's co-host, courtesy of the San Jose office of Berliner Cohen, Josh Borger, the muted Josh Borger, by now well known as a frequent guest on Your Legal Rights. Josh practices commercial and civil litigation in a variety of areas. Josh, do we have your sound working yet? I see your lips moving, so I'm going to assume not. So about 2 years ago, we took a look at managing and planning for the small estate. How does probate work? Why do you want to avoid probate? How do you avoid probate? Can't I just avoid all this if I add my child to my bank accounts, perhaps the deed to my house? What are some of the top myths and misunderstandings about estate planning and probate? And what is a small estate? As always, we're eager to hear what's on your mind and answer your questions. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134 if you're in San Francisco. If you're not in the Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. To help sort out these issues, some of the issues involved in planning your estate, we have with us tonight San Jose attorney Lisa Bryant. Lisa focuses her practice on estate planning and elder law. She passionately advocates for veterans, seniors, and hardworking families. She regularly counsels clients on more complex estate planning issues, including Medi-Cal planning and special needs planning. Lisa prides herself on taking a personal and practical approach to each client's situation. Also with us tonight, Jessica Rowe is a former chair of the San Mateo County Bar Association Probate Section. From the Redwood City firm Aaron Reichert, Carpel, and Riffle, Jessica is the current president of the California Women's Lawyers. The State Bar of California Board of Legal Specialization has certified Ms. Rowe is a specialist in estate planning, trust, and probate law. And with that, Jessica, Lisa, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you for having us.
Before we go further, I'd like to start with this, and I'll make this open to whichever one of you wants to jump in first. But we're talking about probate and how you work it or how you avoid it. Just what is probate?
I can answer that one. This is Jessica. Typically, I'd say in this conversation, we'd call probate the process, the court proceeding when someone passes away and their assets are going to be passed on to whomever their heirs or devisees, the people are to receive their assets. If you die without a trust or you die with anything in your name alone without a beneficiary designation, in order for that asset to pass to your heir, it has to go through what's called a formal probate proceeding, which is the probate court in your county or in the county where the person passed away. You open a formal proceeding, and that's typically what we call probate, going to court to get the assets of a decedent to pass to their heirs.
So Go ahead, Lisa.
I would definitely agree with that. I just, as we kind of talk through the hour, we're going to learn that there are many things that can be done to avoid probate. And you want to think of probate for larger assets, typically real property or larger bank accounts or accounts that are left untitled without beneficiaries.
So is probate cumbersome? Why do people want to avoid it?
It's expensive and it takes a long time. So they usually quote 18 months to start to finish to get a probate through from, opening the probate and then the final distribution. I mean, even now, especially during the pandemic, because of the backup in the court systems, it's taking even longer because you got to get a hearing date once you file your pleadings. You know, if you get a probate done in less than a year, that's light speed. And the other problem is it's expensive. Both the administrator or executor, as well as the attorney for the administrator and executor, get a percentage of the estate as a statutory compensation. And so that means no matter what, they get that percentage. And on top of that, depending on how large the estate is and what county you're in, you can also get extraordinary fees. So on top of a percentage of the estate, you also get an hourly fee. And the third reason why people want to avoid probate is for privacy. You know, when you have a trust, that's not really recorded anywhere in public. No one necessarily knows what you have or who's getting it. When you do a probate, you can search the court's docket and all of the documents that have been filed, and you can see when someone dies what they owned and who received it. And not everybody likes to, you know, have all of their assets and where they're going out there for everybody to learn. So privacy, cost, and time are the three biggest reasons, in my opinion, to avoid probate.
I would definitely agree with that, Jessica. I would also add it's emotional to a lot of people. Due to the time probate takes, it makes family dynamics very stressed. It makes people very worrisome about what bills are being paid, what creditors are out there, who's going to cover the property taxes and the expenses while this probate is going on. And it just creates a family dynamic that can be very stressful for many people. And a living trust, a well-written estate plan can help avoid a lot of that.
Let me turn it over to Ace from San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, I've got a question for you guys. It's sort of like the opposite of what you're saying. What if somebody passes away without any assets but just bills and debts? Does that move on to the next of kin, or for anyone who, you know, comes and claims to be the friends or whatever, do the debts carry on, or do the debts stop when you die? That's the question.
So
normally,
go ahead, Lisa.
Sorry. Normally, a debt will die when you die if it is solely your debt. You do want to make sure that you don't have joint credit cards or any combination of debt with other people. If you are truly have no assets, then unfortunately the creditors just remain unpaid.
Okay, so if somebody, the next of kin won't be liable if they were trying to take care of the funeral expenses and stuff like that. They won't be liable for any debt of the person that passed. Is that correct?
If I understand you correctly, I just want to make sure that they have the same understanding of the question that I think I do. Are you asking, if you arranged the funeral arrangements and the like, would you be liable for those debts? Or are you talking about the debts of the estate?
The funeral arrangements, yeah. The funeral arrangements, I know you'd obviously pay for those. But if you come forward and say, I'm going to take care of this person's remains, you don't adopt their debt because you've stepped forward. That's what I'm saying. Is that's correct, right?
That is correct. That is correct.
Okay.
So you're not personally liable for someone else's debt. And the estate can only be liable up to the value of the estate. So if someone receives $10,000 from the estate and there's creditors, they can get up to $10,000 from the person that received those funds.
Right. Okay, no, great. It was just to put some people's minds at ease. Thank you very much for the information. I appreciate that.
Ace, thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. I don't know why he brought up the picture of the person complaining that his rich uncle just died, and now he's strapped for the timeshare payments for the next 30 years. But obviously probate's kind of cumbersome, it's expensive, and if you're waiting for your widescreen TV, it seems like a long, long time. But how do you avoid probate?
There are several different steps that you can do to avoid probate. I'll cover a couple and I'll let Jessica as well. The main one is to create what's known as a living trust. A living trust is a document in which we name a trustee, a person you want to think of as a manager, someone who technically works for you, works for the trust. And in that document, you name heirs, you name beneficiaries, people to take your property when you pass. And that will go, as Jessica mentioned earlier, without the probate court and typically through a private proceeding. That is one way to avoid the probate court.
I guess the other way to avoid probate, if you don't have so the only assets that go through probate are assets that are in the name of that person, so not in the name of a trust because you've set up a trust, and assets that don't have a beneficiary designation. So if you have an asset that, checking account, well, you can name, someone to receive it when you pass away. an IRA, a 401k, a life insurance policies. All of those are assets that have beneficiary designations. Those do not go through probate. And I know we're going to get to it a little bit later, the idea of a small estate. So under probate code section 13100, if the aggregate value of assets that would normally go through a probate proceeding are $166,250 or less, you can do what's called a small estate affidavit and avoid probate. Typically, that even happens when you set up a trust. You know, you might not have a lot of clients that choose not to title their checking account in the name of their trust because they don't want to check that has the name of a trust. They want their name on it. And their successors will just go do a small estate affidavit for that specific account. I just advise my clients to never have more than $166,000 in a checking account that's not titled in the trust. And that also avoids probate.
One wonders, amongst other things, why they couldn't round off that amount. But a small estate is am I understanding correctly that if there's a limit on the number of assets or the value of the assets in the estate that haven't gone through other means of transfer, then what's remaining would qualify as a small estate. So if I put my house in trust and the timeshare with all its monthly bills in trust and what's left is a small amount of cash on hand or the like, that could be treated as a small estate and avoid probate?
Exactly. And I will just caveat that with, first of all, the $166,250 was just increased from, I think it was $150,000 or $155,000 flat until the one. I don't know the theory behind going up by such a small amount or why it went to $250,000, but it did. And that is just personal property. So like cash, anything that's not real property. The dollar value for real property is actually $50,000. So if you own real property that's not titled in the trust, the only way to avoid that with a small estate affidavit is if it's valued $50,000 or less.
Are there reasons that maybe your assets aren't so high that you couldn't avoid the probate and call it a small estate? Are there reasons you might want to probate it anyway, that you might want to operate a probate even with assets that are less than that oddball amount that the legislature couldn't round off?
The first thing that comes to mind on why you may want to go through a probate could be family dynamics. You're having a hard time getting to decide who could be in charge. A probate will, someone will be appointed by the judge to administer that probate, and they'll be observed by the court. So it gives the family some feeling of control and observation over that process. The other would be for a creditor claim. If you knew that your decedent had a large amount of debt or you aren't sure what the debt may be, you may want to file a probate so you can get the creditor claim period running and see who comes forward against the estate there.
And another reason potentially to open a probate, other than the two that Lisa stated, would be, you know, if the decedent was involved in any litigation, the person that would take over that litigation is the personal representative. And that person steps into the decedent's shoes legally, right? So they can either carry on litigating something or defending something. And the only way that you can get that standing is to be appointed as a personal representative by, you know, a judge in California. So that would be my third reason to open a probate.
So let's talk about some of the other provisions that are in place, things that'll happen if you don't have an estate plan. If your spouse just passed away without an estate plan, does the surviving spouse have to pass their half through a full probate?
The survivor, well, first of all, you don't, when if it's just a spouse is passing away and it's transferred between spouses, there's a proceeding called a spousal property petition in California that allows the surviving spouse to take over their interest in their deceased spouse's estate. You know, to get a little bit down in the weeds, it really also depends on what assets are held by the decedent between community and separate property. So the surviving spouse can only take what they're entitled to. So all of the community property and their portion of separate property. That portion is determined by whether or not they're survived by children and how many children they're survived by. But there is a proceeding called a spousal property petition that avoids a formal probate for any of the assets that a surviving spouse would receive. And their half, that surviving spouse's half, doesn't go through their probate. It's just the decedent's portion of their communal assets that would go through the probate. Or the spousal property, sorry.
A spousal property petition is never quite as long in terms of the time it takes as a probate or as expensive. However, it's not as affordable or as easy as putting your assets into a living trust. So it is a mechanism that is available to avoid probate, but it's not your first choice.
Agreed. Let me turn it next to Diane from San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. My question is, my partner died in the last month. We were California domestic partners since 2004. So it should just his estate and everything should just automatically come to me. I was in charge of the disposal of his body. I went to the San Francisco General with him, et cetera. So
I'm very sorry for your loss, but unfortunately, nothing under the law is automatic.
Okay.
So depending on what assets he had, there still is a procedure to get them over to you. Okay. You are likely the beneficiary or ultimately the recipient of them, but there are still legal steps that have to be done to get them depending on what the asset is. So in that case, we really would recommend that you speak to an attorney to find out which direction you would go depending on the asset that you're trying to get to you.
Okay. I'm paying out of my own pocket right now because we didn't share a joint account. And so I've been trying to get legal help, talking to various organizations in the city, and so far I haven't had luck. I mean, you know, Pardon?
And I understand. Your best step is to take a death certificate to the bank first and simply see if you are the beneficiary on the account.
Okay.
If you are, they'll proceed that way. If there is no beneficiary, perhaps they'll share that with you.
Uh-huh.
And you can do what's called a small estate affidavit. Most banks can supply that form directly to you.
Oh, okay.
So that's your first step, is asking them for their help and seeing what they say to you. And then depending on what you learn there, then we would tell you to move forward with more professional legal advice after you try at that avenue.
Okay, all right. And he worked for the university, so I was on his under his benefits. He filed taxes every year, state and federal, with me on it. And so they said it would take like 30 days for them to come to a conclusion.
Yeah.
I don't quite understand why, if you know.
And again, that's just an institutional timeline from their perspective,
right,
that they've given you to process the paperwork. And that's why I was saying in the beginning that unfortunately nothing is automatic under the law. It's just
right.
going to take time. And that's the one thing you have no control over, is the amount of time that they choose to process the paperwork.
Okay.
So I would just tell you to stay on top of it, because during COVID, things get lost more than ever.
Right.
And just, you'll wait out your 30 days and then just keep pursuing it. But the university should have a definite avenue and mechanism to pass these things. This should be very common for them.
Okay.
So I would really try to contact the HR department.
The clerk that I talked to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I would just tell you, keep following up on that, but what they said to you is correct, and I would just keep following up on that avenue.
Okay, and the same thing with his other investments and stuff, contact.
Correct.
Them.
Correct. Okay. It requires a death certificate for most financial accounts. That's where you start. And then seeing if there's a beneficiary listed on the account.
Okay.
And then if it, depending on the amount of the account,
okay.
And do they have other forms, such as a small estate affidavit form, to allow you to release the account?
Okay.
And if not, if those avenues are not enough, then most likely you're going to need professional legal help.
Okay. I mean, are there any, I've tried different, you know, like the Bar Association, et cetera, and everybody seems to have one caveat or another. I was, you know, trying to have something that was as far as attorneys go, not, you know, too expensive at this point since I'm paying for it.
Depending on your income level, you want to contact your local county bar association and ask for the modest means panel. That typically is some attorneys who volunteer their time to help people with lower income or easier needs. That would be your next step.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Diane, I hope we've been of help. And again, our condolences. We're sorry for your loss.
Thank you. Thank you. All right.
Thank
Bye.
You for joining us.
Uh-huh.
Howard from San Jose, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi there, guys. I have a two-part question. First part being, does all this estate stuff only apply to people that are dead or going to die? Does it also apply to people who are incapacitated or incompetent but still alive?
I'll take that one. So if someone is incapacitated and alive, if they have powers of attorney, they can name someone to act on their behalf. If they do not have powers of attorney, then the court has to appoint a conservator to act on behalf of the incapacitated person to manage their estate or their health care.
Okay.
And the nature of the disability could also change the type of conservatorship that's appropriate. Jessica's smiling because we have one of these that we're litigating right now.
Ew.
That's cool. And that leads me to my second thing. So I am named as a person to handle someone's medical, how would you say, directives, in an advance directive. That's not the same as handling someone's financial stuff while they're incapacitated. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. That would be a separate arrangement.
That would be a power of attorney for finances.
Okay. Power of attorney for finances. Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Sure.
Thank you for joining us. You know, one of the things we haven't talked about and Howard brought up are the living. We spoke a little bit about people that are incapacitated, but what about people that never quite had their full capacity? I'm thinking about children. You want to provide for your children if something happens to you. Where do you go about doing that? How do you find a guardian for your children, for example?
You nominate a guardian, I should say, in a will. So, you know, when people come to my office, the people that, in my opinion, really need an estate plan are people that own real property, because you can't name a beneficiary designation and they tend to be over $50,000 anywhere in our area. And people with children, people with minor children, because you nominate a guardian in your will. It's also important to have a trust when you have children, because ideally you'd like to avoid guardianship if at all possible, because, you know, it ends when a child's 18. That means they get all the money right when they turn 18. But if you settle a trust, you can have those assets held in trust till they turn 21, 25, 30, whatever you want. But if you die without a trust, and you just have a will, or you don't have a will and you have minor children, then the court will have to appoint a guardian for those children, to hold their assets and manage those assets until they turn 18. You know, just like a probate proceeding can be expensive, guardianships can be expensive as well. You have to do annual accountings. There's guardian fees, you know, attorney's fees. It ultimately takes away from the assets that your children will receive.
And to add to that, it's the family dynamic that becomes very important to appoint a guardian. Sudden death brings out very different family dynamics and behaviors. And suddenly the people who you thought had no interest in your children or never wanted to be a guardian for your children suddenly want to step forward. And it could be for many reasons. A lot of people think it's for the financial aspect. They want to have access to funds. Maybe. But the reality is it can be for guilt. It could be they want to make up for what they did to you. However it may be, the emotional component to that. So putting it in your will, having it listed, really keeps the family from having to have that fight I would say out loud amongst each other to really determine that. And also, your parents may not be the best guardian for your toddler as they get older. Things to think about that way. So it is really important that you choose that person and that it doesn't fall upon others to choose it for you.
I'm going to circle back to somebody sitting in a situation like Diane. Are there times that even a spouse might want to go through a full probate rather than just using a petition to transfer the assets?
I would say creditor claims. A spousal property petition doesn't have the same creditor claim period as a full probate. I'm actually probating an interesting estate in Contra Costa County right now. And, you know, it's the surviving spouse, the husband, they have a two-year-old child that died very suddenly and owned a couple businesses. Well, we wanted to be able to make sure that she could receive those businesses and his assets, knowing that there wasn't going to become someone coming out of the weeds wanting a portion of the estate as a creditor. So we decided to put all of the assets through a formal probate so that we could have a full creditor's claim and cut off that period, because a creditor claim period is 4 months from the appointment of the personal representative. If you don't have a formal probate, the statute of limitation for a creditor to file a claim against an estate is 1 year from the date of death. So knowing that you don't have to kind of have that weighing out there can be a big value, especially if you have a complex assets that you're receiving.
Lisa, is there anything you would want to add to that? Or
no, I absolutely agree with that. It really is the creditor claim. It's the peace of mind knowing that you can move on, not wondering what is still out there, especially for your spouses who ran complex businesses or had their own LLCs, things like this that you just aren't sure of titling, you aren't sure of assets. It can really bring closure to the family in a better way than just waiting otherwise.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. We'll be back right after this.
In the film The Sound of Metal, Riz Ahmed played a drummer who loses his hearing. And in his new film, Riz Ahmed plays a rapper facing a life-threatening disease. Riz will tell you why he's attracted to roles about artists who lose it all and why he himself can relate. That's coming up on Q from PRX.
A 7 o'clock check-in for Q from the CBC right here on 91.7 FM and online at kalw.org. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for further details.
Next week on Your Legal Rights, we have an unusual show, a break from our normal routine of nuts and bolts. But in the last year and a half of the pandemics, and we've heard challenges from religious authorities to what may be planned in our best interest to some, and others would see it as challenging their right to free exercise of religion. Next week, we have a feature entitled God and the Law. Your Legal Rights takes a look at the ever-evolving relationship between church and state. In particular, a discussion of when constitutionally protected rights clash with the protections offered under the pandemic. That's next week on Your Legal Rights. Tonight, we're looking back after a couple of years. We're taking a look at managing or planning the small estate. We're glad to be back to resume that discussion. And if you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside the Bay Area, call us toll free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. We're talking about estate planning. We're talking about probate. You're not limited to the point we may be in our conversation. In prepping for this show, I've learned that there's a lot of misunderstandings, a lot of myths about estate planning, about probate. So if I decide not to go through a trust, but I set up a will, isn't that enough to avoid probate?
Well, as we learned today, no, depending on the amount of your estate. If you own real property, it's simply not going to be enough. Depending on the other accounts, maybe you have beneficiary forms, maybe. But like I tell people, estate planning and a living trust, it's not about death. It's also about living. A living trust allows you to name someone to act for you while you are alive, but incapacitated. A stroke, Parkinson's, dementia, all of these things no one plans for. This is not any, no one who got this said this is going to happen to me. But you need to name someone who can act for you. Because although a probate is time consuming and overwhelming, it is nothing compared to a conservatorship, which is when someone is living and you're trying to act for mom and dad today. The rent needs to be paid, the bills got to be covered, the property taxes, and you simply have no access. It is a living trust, a power of attorney, and these documents that will allow you to have that peace of mind while your parents are aging. So please don't just think of living trust as for death. It's really for the living as well.
Let me take this call from Peter from Florida. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Wow, that was awfully fast. In fact, I'm from Florida. I was tuning in. I wasn't even sure if you were live when I called. But it's very relevant to my life, although I haven't articulated the question yet. I'm living right now, my mother's like going to be 83 years old, and she met with a lawyer a few months ago, and she had, it was to write up these kinds of documents you're talking about, and I'm wondering what I should do in terms of supervising that document, having a copy of the document. You know what I mean? I really know nothing about it, and they'd like to keep me kind of distant. My brother's still alive. So the document she has, what would it be called? And do I have any say over its content?
No, you don't, to be perfectly blunt. You know, it's your mother and or your father's document. You know, if they're both capacitated or if your mom's capacitated, she has the right to write any document she wants, name any person that she wants as her fiduciary, and to distribute her assets following her passing any way that she wishes. Now,
can I jump in for a moment?
Yeah.
Peter, let me ask you a couple clarifying questions real quick.
Go ahead.
Is your mother in Florida? Is your mother in California or somewhere else?
No, she's right here right here in Florida with me.
And is she of sound mind?
Yes. I don't agree with her, but, you know.
Well, and while she's living, these documents do belong to her. They are private to her, and only she gets to choose who to share them with. Upon her death, you will be given a copy as an heir at law. And then that's when you can, I don't want to say fight or figure it out between the family of what is said. But unfortunately for now, if she chooses to keep it private, that's where it's going to remain.
Really? I have no... Like, I can only ask, can I get a copy of that? But it's not, it's up to her whether she wants to let me read it.
100%. Correct. And, you know, if it's revocable, just keep in mind, she could give you a copy and change it tomorrow. So what's the point? Oh. Right? If she has capacity and it's a revocable document, you know, who's to say what she gives you today is going to be there tomorrow? And it's really up to your mother, whom she shares her documents with while she's capacitated.
Is that called a codicil? Or is it only for a will?
That's for everything.
Okay.
And actually, in California, I don't believe we have codicils, but we would have an amended or updated
will. No, we do.
Do we have codicils still?
Yeah, okay. So you have an amendment to a trust and a codicil to a will. All, you know, again, if your mother is alive and capacitated, all of those documents are revocable. And under California law, if the person that holds the ability to revoke a document is alive and incapacitated, they are the only person that is entitled to receive any information, has any standing to do anything or to demand a copy of anything. So that's why she doesn't have to give it to anyone essentially but herself.
It just passed through my mind. The most famous case of that was in California with Howard Hughes. Do you talk about that over there? It's like the legitimacy of Howard Hughes' will, Melvin and Howard.
Well, that wasn't actually in California.
It wasn't. It was Texas or something?
That was in Utah, actually.
Okay. I'm going to see that movie again. Fascinating. Okay,
well,
thank
Peter,
you.
Thanks for joining us in your legal rights.
Sure.
Let me turn it to DJ in San Francisco. Welcome to your legal rights.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. If there is a trust estate and one of the spouses passes on and the estate passes to the surviving spouse, when that spouse passes on, if there is a surviving estate, the trust estate
We lost you partway through your questions. The last we heard was the words trust estate.
Boston.
DJ, if you can't hear us, please feel free to call us right back. We're happy to pick up your question, but we've lost your call. Let me turn it to Robin in Alameda. Welcome to your legal rights.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking the call. My question is, I know it's not as good as a regular living trust, but what about this transfer on death for a property? I don't have a big estate, but my brother would like to have my house when I go, and I didn't want to actually put him on the deed right now because he would potentially borrow money on it. So can your guest discuss the transfer on death provisions, if that's applicable in any way?
Are you both comfortable talking about that?
Sure. Yes, you can use the transfer on death. It's for most estate planning attorneys, I'll speak for myself, it's not always ideal because, again, it's not about death. Because that's only good if you are dead. But what if you are not? What if you are incapacitated and we need someone to refinance? We need to get a reverse mortgage. We need to sell and put you in assisted living. Who knows? It just doesn't give the authority for that. In your situation, it may be simple. You spoke of your brother. But for people who have multiple children, we do not just want to give it to our oldest son and trust that he's going to do the right thing and share, because it doesn't always happen. And then there's tax implications that should he even choose to share, it may cause a different tax situation than it would to simply inherit. So the transfer on death deed is it's very rarely used and only in very few situations, in my opinion.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you for the caveat. I will look at it more carefully.
And what I heard from Lisa, just to emphasize and underscore, is what you do now with an idea towards passing it when you pass may affect your ability to borrow on it or do anything you need that comes up in the intervening years. So treat it very carefully.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you for that. I appreciate your program.
Thank you. Thank you very much for joining us in your legal rights.
Good night.
You know, I do have one easy question. Suppose I have a living trust. Isn't that enough? Do I need really other documents?
Yeah. This, a typical estate plan is a trust. If this is a single person, it'd be a trust, a pour over will for that person. The pour over will says anything I forgot to title in my trust, I want to go by way of my trust. So if you buy another asset or obtain another asset and you don't title in your trust, your pour-over will kind of act like a slingshot to get it into the terms of your trust, to pass by the terms of your trust. The next document is a power of attorney for finances. And the reason why that's important is because the trustee of a trust can only control the assets that are titled in the trust. Now, there are many assets, financial assets, that you don't want to title in trust, primarily for tax reasons. And those are typically 401ks, IRAs, life insurance policies, anything with a beneficiary designation, you're not going to title in a trust, but you still need someone to act on your behalf in relation to those assets. And a trustee can't do it because it's not in a trust. The final document would be an advanced healthcare directive. And in my opinion, that's the most important document of an estate plan. I completely agree with Lisa. You know, it's not about what happens when you die. It's about what happens when you're alive and you can't take care of yourself. And you need to have someone make your medical decisions, decide where you're living, how you're living, whether or not you have heroic measures to keep you alive. I mean, there's so many things that affect your daily living when you can't manage it yourself. And it would be the advanced healthcare directive that only names an agent to do that for you, but also gives that agent direction on what you do or do not want done on your behalf when it comes to medical or living decisions. So that's an estate plan, a trust, a will, power of attorney for finance, an advanced healthcare directive.
Let me turn it to Chris in Berkeley. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Well, hi, thank you. I have a question about federal student loans. If you are holding student loans that are in repayment, and you get married, what are the responsibilities of the spouse if you should pass while still holding those loans?
I think what you're asking is whether or not a spouse has liability for separate property debt, and whether or not on your passing they have liability for that separate property debt. Is that right? Am I hearing that right? So it's a debt that you earned before marriage that's separate. You're passing away. At first, yeah. I believe it's my understanding that student debt specifically dies with that person, is my understanding. If it's another type of debt that's a separate property debt, there is a section of the probate code, as well as, I believe, case law, that under certain circumstances, a spouse can be liable for the separate debt of a spouse. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't have that code section or what those circumstances are, but there's the potential for that. But like I said, I do believe, and you can look this up, pretty sure that, and Lisa, you may know this, that school debt dies with that person, other debt, non-school debt. And it might also be depending on the lender as well, whether it's mm-hmm. government school debt or, private school debt. Right. Yeah. Like Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac.
Right.
Correct. Typically, my understanding, Jessica, is the same, that student loans typically will die with the student. However, mm-hmm. as we said, other separate debt, let's say you have your own credit card, but your spouse benefited from that debt, may be transmutable between each other. And that's where you want to be careful. The student loan debt, I too believe, dies with the student.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights. And let me turn it next to Colin in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. I'm not sure if this is on topic. I'm coming late to the show, but my dad died in 2019 in Texas without a will, and his wife, who is my stepmother, is living in his house, which is the only real asset, and she is planning on selling it. I was wondering what my rights might be to the proceeds.
Probate law is a state-by-state issue, and it is something mm-hmm. you really do need to speak to someone in Texas, because each mm-hmm. area is completely different. So that's all I can say to you, is that I don't know what your rights would be, because you really do need to speak to a Texas attorney.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
All righty, thank you for joining us. And let's go to Mel in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question regarding a property in San Francisco. It was purchased by my grandfather and father, and then my grandfather passed away. But my uncle had co-signed the loan. And at the time of my grandfather's passing, the alleged will read that his share of the house was left to me and my siblings. However, there's some question about the legality of that will, and nothing ever happened to it. We were all under 18 at the time. So nothing ever happened to it, and my parents maintained ownership of the property. And my question is, was there something that had to happen at the time of my grandfather's passing where his part of the house should have been transferred to his next of kin, which would have been his own children?
What I'm hearing from your story is that although he had a will, what this really comes down to is, what did the deed say? Most likely, they held the property as joint tenants, meaning all of them had an equal right to the property and the survivor takes all. And therefore, the survivors took it and it was not subject to his will. Therefore, it was not part of his estate in that sense. It didn't count because it went to the other co-owners. That's okay. Just from your story, what I could see that possibly happened. Again, you could ask or go to the county recorder, ask for a copy of the deed. The deed is public record. And you could see if that is the case, if everyone was joint tenants, that is why it passed the way it did and why it skipped the will altogether.
So at the time, I looked up the record of the deed, and at the time, it was my grandfather and father on the deed. And then he passed, and some time later, my mother's name showed up on the deed. And
let's back up a little bit. Let me back you up there. When you said it was your father and your grandfather, it's your father and grandfather, and then they have a title. They hold it as either joint tenants. It's your grandfather and your father as tenants in common. So there's a title after their name. It's that title that instructs how the property goes. So we need to see what was said after their names. And most likely, it was joint tenants, went to the survivor, and then the survivor has the right to add your grandmother's name to the property.
Got it. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us once again on Your Legal Rights. So, my children are difficult, and they're all very different. But to be fair, do I need to put them all in the same position when it comes time to, you know, who takes what? Or could I treat them differently?
You mean who receives what or who's in charge of distributing? I mean, those are two different things.
I was going to ask them separately or simply just say both.
Well, who's in charge? So I have this conversation weekly with clients of, well, I want to name all three or both of my kids as co-trustees. And I say, never a good idea. You know, everybody thinks their kids get along until they don't. And death and money changes many people. So I would say naming people as co-trustees, co-executors, unless you absolutely 100% believe that there is zero issue and they will have zero issue and they can work together, which is a small portion of the time, name them successively. Choose one kid, then name the next. Don't name them together. When it comes to distributing your assets, whether you should, you know, give it equally, you can run the gamut on why people might have a disproportionate distribution to their children. Maybe they gave a lot of gifts to one kid during life. They helped them down payment on their home and they gave them $150,000. So they want to give the child they never helped out, didn't pay for college, didn't give a down payment for, they want to give them a little bit more. when people do propose a disproportionate distribution to me, I ask them a lot of questions as to why. And I make sure I pepper my notes with the reasons why. And I make sure that I ask them multiple times, not just in one visit. Because if one of those children that receives less decides to file a trust or will contest, if I'm the estate planning attorney, I'm the number one witness. And I want to be able to get on the stand and say that I discussed this multiple times with my clients, and this is why they were adamant this was why. And, you know, if it, for lack of a better term, makes sense, then a disproportionate, you know, distribution is not atypical. But there, I do always caution my clients that when you do a disproportionate distribution and you don't have good reasoning, you're potentially setting your children up for litigation on their death. And that's never fun. I do also do trust and estate litigation. So it's great for me, good business when people choose to do that. But it's really sad business because it's a lot of grieving children, you know, fighting for their parents' assets because they felt they weren't treated equally.
I'm in total agreement, Jessica. You have here two seasoned estate planning attorneys, and we're both going to tell you, do not name co-trustees unless you absolutely have to. One, not everyone has the same aptitude to do the job. Truly, how do they deal with stress? How do they deal with grief? How do they deal with finances? It's very, very important. I tell people you might know your children. You don't know your in-laws. You don't know who's influencing them, who's putting pressure on them, how that's creating a family dynamic in the background. And so it really is best to put one and then the other. And then I tell the other beneficiaries, the truth is you don't want to be trustee. It's a thankless job. You don't really want to fight to do it because it really isn't easy per se. It takes time. So it also is who has the time to do it is what we really want to do. When you name two people working together, they have to do a lot together. Even if they get along, can they schedule? Can they make it happen? It's so important to make things go along smoothly, one and then the other. And then as for the disproportional beneficiaries, absolutely. We understand not everyone is created equal. Some children didn't step up the way others did. But like Jessica said, be sure to note it. Be sure to speak it out loud to your family. So it's not us having to say it for the first time when someone has to hear it, because that becomes very painful. And so I tell people, you really want to think about what legacy you want to leave behind, what family dynamic you want to leave for your siblings, for your children. And if it's not that important, equal shares is best. It just keeps the family dynamic a little bit better. Not always right. We understand if you do choose to do disproportional, but really give it some heavy consideration when doing so.
I will add to that. Sorry, Jeff, I know you were saying something. I will add to that. If you're going to do disproportional distribution, tell your kids that that's what you're doing. Because when it's sprung on them after you pass away, that's when you have litigation. I always ask my clients when they come in and they want disproportional, have you discussed this with your children? Do they understand that you're going to benefit one or the other, or maybe disinherit someone? If they come in and say, yeah, my son's a millionaire, he doesn't need the money, then it allows for it to flow a little easier once they pass away.
Is it also feasible to include within the documents themselves some justification or idea what you were thinking? This is why I'm really doing this. I still love you equally, but look at this. You know, you own five houses and your brother's lives on the streets.
It's risky. I've done this. It's called a statement of intent. If I had to say a percentage of the time that I do a statement of intent when I have a disproportionate distribution, 5% of the time I do a statement of intent, because you're also setting yourself up for claims of mistake, right? So if a parent believes something is one way and they put that in the statement of intent, that's a huge grounds to set that aside based on mistake of fact. So a parent didn't actually have all of the facts. They chose to give one child something more because they were under a mistaken belief of something. You know, the times I do statements of intent, usually are when the parent has had clear conversations with their children about the disproportionate, or they've given big gifts and they say, we've given our child X, Y, and Z. That's why this other child is receiving something more. Like, it, I'm making it fair by giving you less on my debt, essentially.
So we're really running out of time, and I wanted to give each of you maybe 1 to 2 minutes for any closing thoughts, anything you wanted to close with. Who would like to go first?
Where can you go, Lisa?
Sure, I can go first. I tell people, again, a living trust, you want to think of it, it's not about death and dying. It's about the living. It really is about making sure you have someone there so when you become incapacitated and unable to do it for yourself. You want to have a good power of attorney. You want to look over your power of attorney and see if it's immediate or springing. A springing power of attorney springs into effect when two doctors sign off. An immediate power of attorney takes effect today. If you trust and know your children, if you're of a certain age, double check your power of attorney and make sure it's immediate. Make sure someone can help you without having to go through difficult steps to do so. The harder you make it for them, the less likely they'll want to do it. So we really want to try to make it easy for those who want to help you. More importantly, you really do want to seek out legal advice. And I'm not just saying this as an attorney who gets paid to say this, but truly, these are expensive mistakes. There are tax implications to what you do. As we heard earlier with the woman who had the transfer on death deed, there's just implications to doing that. So she just needs to know. Be advised and then make your decision. But do seek out legal advice when it comes to your most important assets and your family. That's it. It's your house, the biggest asset you own, and the people you love. And that's what estate planning is here to protect. And only through good planning and good legal advice can you be sure and have peace of mind.
Jessica, would you like to follow up with another, maybe 1 to 2 minutes?
Sure. You know, I actually agree very much with Lisa. And just to add to the idea of, you know, it's important to plan for while you're alive and incapacitated. You know, when I'm talking with clients about who to choose as a trustee, that's when I really talk about when you're alive and incapacitated. Don't think about so many people, well, who, I don't care who it is. They're just going to split my money up and give it to my kids. And I said, no. Don't think about when you're dying. Think about you've been in a car accident. You can't manage your own money. You're, you know, sick in a hospital bed. Who do you trust to manage your finances for you? If your kid can't balance a checkbook, don't name them as your successor trustee because they're not going to balance your checkbook when you're in the hospital. And then also, I also want to reiterate what Lisa says about, you know, getting legal advice. Again, you know, it gives me a lot of work as a litigator when people use legal Zoom or try to do things on their own, because most of the time things go bad and it ends up in court. You know, a probate of $1 million estate in California between, you know, administrator fees and legal fees could be $50,000 to $60,000. For $1 million estate, you know, you could spend a couple grand on estate planning and think about how much you're saving your family.
Thank you. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco, where tonight we resumed our discussion of planning for the small estate. Our guests have been Jessica Rowe from Redwood City and Lisa Bryant from San Jose. Thank you both for joining us. Next week, in a feature called God and the Law, Your Legal Rights takes a look at the ever-evolving relationship between church and state, featuring a discussion of when the constitutionally protected right of free exercise of religion during a pandemic often clash. That's Your Legal Rights next Wednesday night at 6 o'clock. Our show tonight's been produced by Josh Borger and yours truly. And a big thanks to tonight's guests, Lisa Bryant and Jessica Rowe, and especially to all of you for joining us. And at the controls, Damian D. Minor. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night, and thank all of you for listening. Be safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Laura Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org. You're listening to 91.7 KALW. San Francisco Bay Area. Thank you.